Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a weekly podcast to keep you up to date on what's new on our cloud platform, Microsoft Azure. Your hosts, Cynthia Crane, Evan Basilik, Suji DeMello, Kendall Roden, Kel Teeter, and Russell Young discuss a different service or solution on each show, with subject matter experts to explain how to get started, how different services work, and how to make decisions in tricky scenarios. You can find out more about our podcast at azpodcast.com or follow us on Twitter at Azure Podcast.
Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast.
This is episode number 352,
being recorded on the 28th of October, 2020, with special guest Michael Howard. I'm Sujit, and on Teams with me, I have Kendall, Kale, and of course, our special guest, Michael, who we're going to get to in just a minute. Really excited to have him on. He's got his own podcast, which he's going to talk about, and a very unique area of expertise in Azure security. We're excited to hear all about that. But before that, Kale, I believe you put a couple of updates in the OneNote.
I sure did. So this one is kind of a continuation of maybe it was a couple podcasts ago. We talked about the Azure cost management and billing and that kind of stuff that goes along with Azure. And there's another update. So the team over there has been making some pretty cool updates. And they have an October 2020 version of some of the updates as well. There's some new things in here, like the Azure Advisor Score, which is basically like kind of giving you an assessment. You know, optimization for your how your cloud usage is, you know, wasting things, but also, you know, I do believe there is some stuff here around the security front, which is maybe more relevant to today's conversation. Talks a little bit about, you know, some of the ways that you can now create subscriptions with ARM templates. I didn't know that was available, so that's kind of news to me. There must be some updates on the ARM side for that. And then there's some cost management lab stuff, some new pieces that they put out there. So we'll drop the link in the notes. There's a lot of stuff in here. We probably actually, since these guys have been doing so many updates, maybe we should bring them on a podcast here soon and talk about it. I mean, the feedback I've heard from partners and others around this kind of stuff that we've been investing in here is it's pretty awesome and it's pretty differentiated because it helps people make sure that they're A, doing the right things as much as possible, recommended practices, but also like optimizing their cloud spend so they're not wasting you know, a bunch of money on stuff that's not useful. The second one I had was around smart cities or smart buildings rather, and this is kind of a little more high level kind of article from one of the PMs on the IoT team, which basically talks through, you know, digital twins and how IoT has come together with a bunch of other technology we have, including like computer vision, spatial analysis stuff, and some of our mapping features and all those pieces to basically allow these kind of Legos or building blocks that make it easy to do things like smart buildings. And when I say like smart buildings, it's things around management using, you know, a whole host of sensors and things like that to optimize things like heating and cooling or space efficiencies, things like that. There's also a company mentioned in here, a partner, RXR Realty, who happens to be here in New York City. I've spoke with these guys before, and they have some pretty cool stuff that they're building around, you know, the smart building space as well, using Azure and the IoT in the cloud and stuff like that. I think some of theirs is actually been helpful here as part of this COVID piece, which basically is helping people determine, you know, how full something is, you know, like a building and things like that. So it's kind of parlaying nice into the situation that we're in this world today with COVID. There's also another partner mentioned in here, Brookfield Properties, who's doing something similar on the digital twin side. But pretty nice article there if you're into the smart city stuff and seeing how all these like Lego blocks can be kind of put together to form a cool solution that's very useful. Check it out.
That's awesome. I have actually just put in three updates. I just saw they were out on AKS. One of them is around using AKS with proximity placement groups. And this is allowing, like, you know, AKS cluster can be made up of a bunch of nodes. And if you have a workload that where the latency between those nodes should be as low as possible, maybe it's a gaming system or something like that, and you want to make sure that they're actually hosted within the same data center, and you know, hopefully within the same rack if possible, or whatever, however close they can be hosted. They you can use this feature now for proximity placement groups in AKFs. This was always available through VMs, but they've exposed that through the AKS API as well. And kind of related to that is the ability in AKS now to add spot instances, which is another feature that's been there in the VM world. The ability to use these very low priority VMs. So based on availability, as long as there's excess capacity in the region that you're looking to host, you get these very low cost VMs. But the downside is that there's no SLA on those VMs because, you know, if the capacity does come up, then those VMs could be taken away. So you got to, you know, again, these are for workloads where, you know, you need to run something, but it's not time sensitive, right? It's something that if it takes a little longer, you don't mind waiting. But you get significant discounts with these VMs.
Sajid, on that point, not to go in here too deep, and maybe you don't know the answer, but like, how does that work, like with the spot instances? And if so, maybe we should pull someone in here to talk about it. But like, if I'm running one of those, and you're like you said, you could be preempted. Do you get like an email or something and says like, hey, in 5 minutes your stuff's gone? Or I just wondered.
Yeah, I'm trying to recall back when we did have the PM for spot instances on. They explained this to them, but I think what you're saying is correct. You do get like a heads up that, hey, you know, the capacity is increasing and you're probably going to be, the number of servers is going to be reduced. So maybe if you'd ask for 10, maybe it's come down to 2 or 3 or something like that, you know, the number of nodes. So you have to be prepared. Your application has to be sensitive to that.
Yep. Okay, cool. Thanks.
And then kind of the third one also in the AKS world is pod identity. I think we're, you know, this has been there for a while, but they're now finally, in a sense that it's been, they've been working on it for a while, but they've now made it available as a public preview. And essentially this allows every pod to have like an AAD identity. It's automatically injected into the pod. So if your pod has code that's say accessing Key Vault or something else that can be authenticated and authorized with Azure AD tokens, the whole process is kind of automatic, right? You don't have to have all the code in your logic in your code to get tokens and whatnot. It's kind of already acquired for you, and then you can just access these resources with minimal fuss. So those are some of the updates on the AKS this week. I just happened to catch a whole bunch of them there. I think we're good to go. Kendall, anything from your side you wanted to talk about?
Nope, you stole my thunder with all the AKS updates. You got it.
Sorry about that.
I'm good though on my end. Thanks.
Okay, great. All right, so then let's turn the mic over to Michael. Michael, thank you for joining us today. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself to our listeners. Let us know what you do at Microsoft, what your passion is in the Azure space, and we'll take it from there.
Hey, Sajid. Thank you so much for having me on. Yes, my name is Michael Howard. I've been at Microsoft for a short time now, 28 years. I've always been involved in security in one way, shape, or form, although I did start work doing C compiler support on Windows 3.0 back in the day at Microsoft in New Zealand. I ended up moving to Redmond to work on IIS. I was the security PM for IIS 3, 4, 5, and 6. And then I ended up moving into sort of secure software development side of the house. If any of you are familiar with the security development lifecycle, that's my little baby. Mm-hmm. And then I finally ended up moving to Austin and work in services now, mainly almost 100% in Azure and security. So my passion is security, 100%.
So I know you've obviously channeled that passion, and you know, you've also started your own podcast focused on Azure security or security topics in general. And I'm sure as a result of that, you must have heard something from the listeners or from people that you talk to on the show. Like, what would be some of the things that are top of mind in the security space these days? What are the trends that you're seeing today?
Yeah, so I want to start off by saying, you know, first and foremost, yeah, we have the Azure Security Podcast. It's myself, Mark Simos, Sarah Young, and Gladys Rodriguez. And we're all, you know, security nerds in one way, shape, or form. I think Sarah is probably the closest to you, Kendall. She gets really excited about anything that includes the word Kubernetes. But yeah, so we started the podcast. I'll be honest, it's modeled on the Azure podcast. I'm going to be brutally honest with you. You guys are literally the inspiration for the Azure Security podcast. And I'm not just saying that to pander to you guys. It's actually completely true. But there's a lot of trends that we've seen over the last few years. It wasn't that long ago when people would literally say, not over my dead body are we going to put anything into the cloud from a security standpoint. And that's really changed. That's really changed substantially. I think a lot of customers can see, in fact, the majority of customers see the benefits of moving to the cloud, not just from a cost savings perspective and an agility perspective, but also from a security perspective. You know, when you look at the shared responsibility model, especially when you start to move to like PaaS components, you know, platform as a service components, where a lot of the security posture really becomes Microsoft's responsibility as opposed to you, the customer's responsibility. I could go through all sorts of war stories to back that up. In fact, I'll tell you one now, because I think this is a really good example. And it actually involves Kubernetes. There was an issue some months ago, quite some time ago now. There was a potential DDoS amplification vulnerability in Kubernetes, and it was really quite serious. And I remember I was working with a customer at the time, a large financial customer, and we were doing some sprint planning. And one of the items that came up was get a handle on all the Kubernetes clusters. And this is like a month after the vulnerabilities had been fixed. So I spoke to one of the guys. I'm like, what are you talking about? This has been fixed. It's like, yeah, but all the on-prem Kubernetes clusters, we have no idea where they all are. We have no idea if they're patched. We have no idea what state the patches are in. We don't know what version numbers they're on. We just don't know. And we're at risk. And I said, but you do realize that all the ones you guys have in, you know, AKS on Azure are all patched, right? And they're like, yeah, we know. And that really, I think, solidified the fact that, you know, more customers are moving stuff into the cloud because some of the responsibility falls on Azure. You know, it's Microsoft's responsibility to make sure that the underlying components are running anti-malware, to make sure that they're patched accordingly. And then when you layer on top of that all the security controls that we have and all the security tooling that we have, and then when you layer on top of that all the DDoS protections that we have that you don't have to worry about as a customer, you know, as well as lots of other security advances, which I can certainly talk about, especially around cryptography and network isolation. You know, it's that those old days of people saying, you know, essentially over my dead body, those days are long gone.
So it sounds like what you're almost saying is that the customers are starting to trust the cloud more than on-prem.
I would say the vast majority, yes. I mean, don't get me wrong. There are some that, you know, they're still sort of stuck in that on-prem mindset, and they try to take on-prem designs out into the cloud. And to be honest with you, it really doesn't fly. It just doesn't. And so if you come with that mindset, you're just not going to be successful. You really have to think about new ways of securing systems. And I want to go one step further with this. And I realize this is completely off topic, but, you know, one bit of advice that I would give people who are moving to the cloud, you know, specifically Azure, you know, if you're coming from an on-prem world, you have to start understanding the security, privacy and compliance implications of moving to the cloud. You have to understand what the new defenses are. You have to understand what the new threats are, what the mitigations are, what technologies you have at your disposal. I would argue that if you don't do that, then your career prospects are limited in the future. Let's just leave it at that. But I believe that sincerely. I mean, you have to start getting out of that on-prem mindset. You know, the firewall, sort of this hard boundary and a soft, squishy interior just doesn't fly. And especially when you start thinking about zero trust networking, you know, in Azure, you start to think about, you know, explicitly checking for all security access to things. You start thinking about identity. So you brought up pods, right? Pods in Kubernetes is a classic example, right? The fact that we've now added identities to pods, like you said correctly, it's been around for a little while, but we've just made it a lot easier now. That is critically important. Right now, I can lock down access to, as you pointed out, Key Vault or any other resource, other resources. I can lock it down to a small number of pods. And that is absolutely fantastic.
So I have a question for you. First of all, this is such a great topic just because there is so much, and I think we need an Azure security podcast. I think that there is so much to cover on that, that's brilliant. One thing that has definitely been emerging, at least in my sphere, is this concept of like confidential computing and confidential containers, and basically like securing not just data in transit, but like data that's like actively at rest. Like it's pretty interesting to me, just the concept of that. And sometimes I think like, how far can we take this? Like, I know that that's really being baked into the platform and it's amazing, but I'm also like, how often do we see attackers like really exploiting like those particular things, right? Like how much can we protect for to the point where it's like so overwhelming to try to implement all of these different features? And I know that's kind of a whole nother conversation, but I'm kind of curious, like, what is your thought on the whole concept of the confidential computing landscape and these like secure enclaves and stuff like that? And I'm coming from, you know, a small, very minute, you know, 100 level background on those topics. So hope I didn't do it I hope I did it justice in the way I explained it a bit.
Though, you know what, you picked on one of my pet topics. So how long do we have? Because I could be here all day talking about this topic. It's a topic I'm deeply, deeply passionate about. So let me sort of go through it real quickly. So I spend a lot of time working with healthcare, a lot of financial organizations who have extremely sensitive workloads. And we're always talking about encryption of data at rest. We're talking about encryption of data on the wire, you know, TLS, you know, TLS 1.2 is basically always the correct answer there. And, you know, with confidential computing and secure enclaves, we kind of have this, as you correctly pointed out, Kendall, you know, security, encryption of data while it's in use. And the poster child for that is probably SQL Server. So SQL Server, you know, supports secure enclaves. And for those of you who are not familiar or listening, essentially what happens is, if we take SQL Server as an example, it runs part of its query engine in the secure enclave. And what that means is you have this boundary around the code that is handling sensitive data. And so the data is not in plain text until it's inside the secure enclave. So basically your whole system, the data is always encrypted. From the outside perspective, it is always encrypted. And that is really, really cool because it now opens up very sensitive workloads because the data is always encrypted. The problem with it is that it's quite technical. And I think this is one of the things that we have in Azure that's really useful and really quite unique, is that we have an ability to make very complex things quite straightforward. And so we'll start to see over time more and more services in Azure take on confidential computing. One of the first ones that we see in Azure is obviously these containers, where you can run, again, really sensitive workloads where the data is encrypted all the time. The only time it becomes decrypted and operated on is inside the secure enclave. And that enables all of a sudden very, very, you know, sensitive workloads to be handled in the cloud with trust, with a great deal of trust and confidence. It does take some work to take an existing service and update it, you know, to make it, you know, to use it with secure enclaves. And I'll be also straight honest with you. You know, if you have, say, a workload in SQL Server today, and you decide to implement SQL Server 2019 inside of VM or even on-prem, and you turn on secure enclaves, you will probably have to make some changes to the SQL queries, because not every single SQL query will work because of the way the enclave works. And that's one of the downsides that we have to think about. But for greenfield environments, and if you're in a highly regulated industry, you have to start, in my opinion, you've got to start looking at secure enclaves as an option for some workloads. So it does require quite a bit of experience and a bit of expertise to understand how it works. And I'm going through this right now with a customer, a healthcare customer. And there's a few bumps along the way. But once we get there and we get these bumps ironed out, I think we will see a lot more sensitive workloads being moved to Azure, especially in the healthcare side of the house. And I do want to address one other question you brought up, which was, you know, obviously it doesn't mitigate everything, and that's absolutely true. It does not mitigate, for example, a weakness in your supply chain. So let's say you decide to build some code, and you, by the way, we have a thing called the Open Enclave SDK. So you can actually write your own code and run it inside of VM. There are special compute VMs, which are support confidential computing, and you can run your code in there in a secure enclave using the Open Enclave SDK. But if you decide to include a library that's malicious and you don't realize it, you've now got a malicious library running inside the secure enclave. And that, you know, we can't mitigate that. So it's not a silver bullet, but man, it opens up some business scenarios that have historically been impossible to do.
Yeah, Michael, the other thing that I'd like to bring up, and I've seen this with a lot of my customers, especially financial services customers, is the topic of key management. You know, he starts off with SSL certificates, SSL keys, and then, you know, client certificates, encryption keys, and so on and so forth. And it always turns out being a mess, right? They expire, people forget, things go down. At the same time, we all understand that, you know, the whole security world runs on these things. What have you heard? Like, what are some of the, I would say, like the best practices people should consider, especially when they are moving to Azure?
So this is Michael's pet topic number two, which is key management. always been a bit of a crypto geek. So the problem with crypto isn't crypto, right? The problem with crypto is key management. It's always been key management. So the general rule of thumb is, you know, you should always store keys, encryption keys, certificates plus their private keys, AES symmetric keys, and so on. You should always store them in Key Vault if you're running in Azure. I like to say, it's a very flippant comment, but I like to say it, you know, anything else is varying degrees of badness from Key Vault. So you really need to focus on Key Vault. And there's a bunch of really good reasons for it. One, it's actually a very reliable, very robust, very convenient service that we have inside of Azure. It's well understood. We have authentication, authorization into it. We have audit policies. We've now got one thing we're going to be talking about on the Azure Security Podcast, this we're recording this afternoon, is that there's now the ability to put an RBAC policy down on the individual keys or individual secrets or individual certificates, which is way, way cool. Historically, it's always been at the sort of key vault level, but now you can do it down to individual entities. But you have to understand that key vault turns a cryptographic problem into an authentication and authorization problem. That's all it does at the end of the day. Like if you have a key, let's just say a secret in key vault, well, who has access to it? You know, now it's a, you know, again, it's an authentication and authorization problem. That's why it's so exciting seeing things like pods taking on managed identities or service principles, because now I can authenticate and authorize that identity to, well, now actually read just that certificate and just its that one private key and nothing else. So as you can see, it's an authentication and authorization problem now. So people say, well, you can do hardware signing inside of Key Vault, which is absolutely true. So where's the authentication and authorization in there? Well, the thing is, the key may be in hardware, but who has that? Who's allowed to do the signing operation? You're not disclosing the key, but who can do the signing operation? And then you use the key, you know, by proxy, essentially. So again, it's an authentication and authorization problem. So I think the number one thing that people have to understand is that Key Vault, again, I know I've already used this term, but it's no silver bullet. Just putting things in Key Vault doesn't mean things are magically secured now. You've now got to start thinking about the access control. And that has to be, you know, not, you know, I've seen customers say, we just put everything in Key Vault. My next question is, okay, so who has access to the resources? How do you do the authentication? How do you do the RBAC policies? How do you do the authorization? You know, those kinds of things. And the nice thing about Key Vault is that you do have the likes of lifecycle management, especially for certificates, which is really problematic. There's nothing worse than having a certificate expire on you. And we've seen that many times. We've seen services both at Microsoft and outside of Microsoft where services have gone down because a certificate expired. So we have lifecycle management in there. So sort of to reiterate, you know, when in doubt, Key Vault. But Key Vault turns a crypto problem into an identity problem. And make sure you have all the lifecycle management, auditing, RBAC policies, so on and so forth.
Yeah, I think that's super interesting, Michael. Also, Key Vault's kind of a passion for me from the blockchain side of the world because we've often been trying to find ways and have used ways to leverage Key Vault the best way. But I think I'd be interested to hear your take a little bit on the combination of those two things you were just talking about. So like confidential compute and Key Vault and managed identities. I feel like to me, like those things coming together is something more powerful, right? If I, to your point, right, initially when we were working on blockchain workloads, we were like, oh yeah, we got this curve inside the Key Vault. We could just use it to do the signing operations. And then you start hitting like scalability issues and all kinds of other things, right? Because you've just pushed a bunch of compute into this thing. And then you're trying to figure out like how to deal with that. And I feel like the combination of some of these stuff coming together, including confidential compute, can really make a pretty powerful, you know, secure solution. That's what we've been kind of pushing on. I'm interested to hear your take on that though.
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, the aspect you brought up about scalability is critically important. I mean, if you're doing essentially signing a block inside of Key Vault, you know, how many are you doing? You may have some performance problems. I mean, absolutely. So in theory, and I'm sort of winging it here, I'll be honest with you. You know, I talk to customers on many, many occasions about topics like this where we say, look, just pull the key out of Key Vault or wherever it's stored, but it better be Key Vault. You know, load it into your confidential, you know, essentially your enclave, and have the key long lived inside of the enclave, you know, running in memory in the enclave. And when the enclave starts up, you know, it pulls it out of Key Vault again. And you may want to run that in a VM, use a managed identity on the VM to be able to give access to the Key Vault, only read access. In fact, now with the new RBAC policies, you can say only read access to that one elliptic curve key. So yeah, again, and I think you sort of touched on it there, and that is, these are greater than the sum of the parts. They really are. You know, a lot of people don't realize, you know, you sort of touched on, you know, keys in elliptic curve keys in Key Vault for blockchain. I mean, that's why the P256K key is there, or curve is there, is exactly for blockchain support. But yeah, I mean, you know, if you need to pull a key out, assuming it's exportable, of course, I don't see any reason why you can't have that key long lived inside of a secure enclave. I see no problem with that whatsoever.
Yeah, I believe when we had Amit Bhatia, who's the PM for Key Vault, on a while ago, he suggested that really there's no reason not to use multiple Key Vaults for your application. Like there's no cost penalty, you know, for having like hundreds of Key Vaults. Of course, you have to manage them. But if you ever hit a performance limit of a key, single Key Vault, the idea is just to short it and have multiple Key Vaults. And, you know, that kind of alleviates that problem. But Michael, I'd like to kind of circle back with you on, you know, some of the other kind of best practices or tips that you would suggest our listeners look into. Let's say, you know, you're coming to Azure, you're dropping an application there. You mentioned key management as being one core tenant. What are some of the other, you know, things they should be doing by default, like when they have their application running in Azure? What would you configure along with the application to make sure it's secure?
You know, I would actually bubble up one level above that, and that is, so if you're designing something on Azure, whether it's, you know, whether it's new, whether it's lift and shift, whether it's something in between. One thing that we do a lot with customers is build a threat model for what they want to build and what they want to deploy. And that way we can make sure that we have all the appropriate mitigations in place. You know, so for example, let's just take like Kale's example, right? So we've got a VM running a secure enclave that we've written using the Open Enclave SDK. And we're accessing Key Vault to pull an elliptic curve private key out, and we're using that for blockchain use. Actually, the real solution there is move blockchain over to using secure enclaves, but that's a discussion for another day. But let's just assume we've done that. So now I have on the threat model, I have a Key Vault and I have a VM that's accessing the Key Vault. So the first question I'm going to ask is, when the VM connects to the Key Vault, how do I know it's actually the valid Key Vault and not somebody else's Key Vault? And the answer is there, you know, what authentication are you using? And 9 times out of 10, the correct answer there is TLS, because TLS will do the authentication for you. So the next question is, okay, so when Key Vault sees a request coming in from this VM, how does it know it's that VM? How are you authenticating the VM? And the answer, the correct answer there is managed identities, right? So now I can actually, versus there is no authentication. So somebody's making a request into Key Vault and pulling a key out. You have no idea who it is. That's kind of bad. So we need to make sure there's strong authentication going on there. And again, the correct answer, you know, some people say, well, we're going to use a username and password embedded in some config file inside of the VM. That's the wrong answer. So next question is, so how are you protecting that config file? And again, it's turtles all the way down, right? It's, you know, well, we encrypt it. Well, where's that key? Well, we encrypt it. Well, okay,
it's the chicken and the egg problem.
It's all the way down. Yeah. And again, the nice thing about managed identities is the buck stops with Azure Active Directory, right? You don't have access to the credential directly. It's all managed by AAD, which is really, really nice. I mean, there's no chicken and egg scenario there. So if someone would say, well, we're using managed identities from the VM out to Azure Key Vault, we have an RBAC policy on Key Vault that says this VM can read this one particular key. Fantastic. The threat model shows that you've done it correctly. And obviously, a solution is going to be more complex than that. But that's where my starting point would be. And then invariably, we start talking about, you know, okay, so you got some data at rest. How is it encrypted? Where's the key stored? Unless you got a blob storage account, as an example. Okay, so for data at rest, how do you encrypt it? Well, we use a customer managed key. And, by default, that'll be stored in Key Vault. That's fantastic. Then we start talking about things like network isolation. That's where private link, private endpoint starts to enter the discussion at this point. So I would start with a threat model. I would absolutely start with a threat model.
So just to dig in there just a little bit deeper, Michael, maybe you could help our listeners understand, is there any tooling or anything out there to help people? So when you go to someone and say, hey, you should create a threat model for this, how should they approach that, right? Is that something that they should just inherently know and go learn about? Is there tooling that can help them, like in any of our tools, to help them build threat models and like maintain them so that they can use them going forward?
Yeah, it's funny. There's no one single correct answer there. There is the Microsoft Threat Modeling tool. It's a free download, and it can certainly help you out. And there is an Azure template that you can use. My personal preference, although some people at Microsoft are not going to like this answer, but it is what it is. I have a Word template that I use, a Word document template. That's all I do. And I basically paste the architecture at the top. And down the bottom is a whole bunch of questions. One thing I'll do if you guys are interested in, I'll give you a whole bunch of material, and you're more than welcome to post it on your site, which is basically, C-spot learn threat modeling. I would definitely, start at the basics. To back up one more level, Kale, you said, that people should inherently know. Yes, absolutely. If you're designing systems in a modern environment, you are doing the design work, you have to understand threat modeling. You have to understand what an attacker can potentially do to a system and understand what the appropriate mitigations are. And the threat modeling process is actually pretty straightforward. I mean, I'll give you a real simple example. Just harking back to this example that we had before of a VM talking to Key Vault. A Key Vault is a process. So it is subject to spoofing, which means I need to care about the authentication. So when someone connects to it, how do we know that that's actually the real Key Vault and not an enemy's Key Vault? And the answer is authentication. And 9 times out of 10, the correct answer there is TLS, like TLS 1.2. And invariably, we'll also end up having this discussion about, okay, what version of TLS are you using? How do you enforce it? That kind of thing. And then because there's a connection being made from a VM to Key Vault, which is a network connection, you got a data flow there. So data flows are subject to tampering and information disclosure. And because it's data on the wire, the mitigation there is always cryptographic. So what cryptographic controls do you have on the wire? And the answer is, well, we're already using TLS 1.2. Fantastic, right? We've solved the server authentication problem and we've solved the channel protections at the same time, all in one fell swoop. And that's one of the nice things that, which actually brings back the initial comment that Sujeet brought up, was about people moving to the cloud, being secure or not. One thing that's really cool about PaaS offerings is a lot of these mitigations are on by default. Like you look at Key Vault. Key Vault requires TLS. You cannot connect to Key Vault over a non-TLS connection. End of story. So that means I've got server authentication taken care of and I've got channel protections taken care of. And what work have I actually done? Nothing whatsoever, which is perfect because you really want to make security as frictionless as possible. And one thing that you'll notice is as you move away from on-prem, where you have to do absolutely everything, to running VMs inside of Azure, where you have to do a lot, but then we start to move to PaaS solutions, a lot of that security work is being done by Azure, which makes building threat models and making sure the appropriate mitigations are in place becomes automatic.
That's pretty well put there. Michael, I want to just ask you, coming back to your podcast, give us a flavor for what topics you've covered so far and what our listeners, your listeners of your podcast could expect going forward. Where do you see the focus areas going forward?
So what's interesting about the Azure Security Podcast is the reason why the four of us are on the podcast is that we all operate at different levels of the stack. I'm very much a low-level guy. I love the low-level stuff. I love the crypto. I love diving inside of Kubernetes to make sure I understand how all the communication works and how I can secure all that communication. That's why I'm really excited about this pod identity thing, for example. Then you got Mark Simos as an example. Obviously, we're all very technical people, but Mark operates at a much higher level. He's really good at the policy aspect. He's really good at the governance aspect. He's good at the overarching compliance programs that must come to bear, at a CSO level, chief security officer level. In the middle is, Gladys and Sarah. Don't get me wrong. It's not like Mark can't dive into the deep stuff and I can't go up to the high stuff and, Sarah and Gladys can't do likewise, but we operate at different levels. And there's a reason for that. I don't want this to be a crypto podcast. I don't want this to be a, in the weeds Kubernetes podcast. There's a bit of a joke about that at the beginning about, is this going to become a Kubernetes security podcast? So one thing you can expect from the Azure Security Podcast is we will cover the whole spectrum of everything from in the weeds all the way up to, high level compliance stuff. So, for example, the one we're recording in 2 hours is exactly that. It's the top 10 Azure security practices. It's relatively high level, sort of stuff that would appeal to chief security officers and chief information security officers. Developers, I probably wouldn't listen to it. It's of no major consequence to you, but unless you really want to know. So we'll cover the whole spectrum. I mean, some of the topics that we've had, Cosmos DB security was one of my favorites. Just because I'm a huge fan of Cosmos DB, if for no other reason. We also have one on container security. My guess is we'll need to do that again because that was in May and the world has shifted significantly since then. We've done identity. We've done private link, private endpoint, another favorite topic of mine. We did a wrap up, a special sort of out of band episode on security news from Microsoft Ignite. We've done Microsoft Graph. We actually did one on confidential computing, Azure, Microsoft Threat Protection. Identity, it really is the whole spectrum.
And on the show, on the show, will it typically be the four of you having a discussion, or will you bring on guests? I'm just kind of curious how that'll work.
Oh no, it's guests. Essentially, what we do is, again, this is kind of modeled on your model, so we hope it works. But I mean, obviously, you guys have been hugely successful, so we think we will be too. But yeah, we have the four of us discuss the news at the very beginning. There's always plenty to talk about, in part because it's every 2 weeks. But even so, even if we did it every week, there will still be a lot to talk about. And we have our own areas of expertise, so we tend to break up the news by individual and areas that they care about. And then we bring on guests, absolutely, to talk about their area of expertise, absolutely.
That's great, yeah. I was just going to quickly say about container security. Oh my God, that thing comes up so often, and everyone has their own opinions about, what level of Linux access you want to give, the UID that should be allowed access. It goes down this huge rabbit hole at that point.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And in fact, one thing about Kubernetes, I'm not sure if I respect it or fear it, but it's probably just both. But it is a multidisciplinary product when it comes to security. Again, you talked about things like, what identity do you run the container as? That's just one tiny little facet of running a Kubernetes environment. Recently, I've just been dealing with a with an issue with a massive company about potential vulnerabilities on container images. And how do you fix them? How do you remedy them? You know, well, the fixes come from the vendors, from, you know, Ubuntu or Red Hat. And if they decide not to fix them, then, you know, that can be of, I'm not going to say of concern, but it's something we need to be cognizant of. So it is very much a very complex area. There are very few people who sort of understand all the moving parts of Kubernetes security, and it's constantly evolving.
So how do listeners find your podcast? They can just search for it online or through Spotify. Like, where are you guys being published right now?
Yeah, we're in all the places: Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and now Amazon Podcasts. Or they can just go to azsecuritypodcast.net, all hosted on Azure, by the way. That will be, and that gives the links to all the both the each individual episode, as well as links directly to Apple, Spotify, Google, and Amazon.
I hope they're encrypted and digitally signed, so I know that they're coming from you.
they can't be encrypted, because now we've got a key management problem. I could digitally sign them. I mean, we could digitally sign them, but yeah, not encrypted, because now I've got to share the key with you.
How do I know this is Michael Howard talking here now?
That's a good point. You don't, right? You absolutely really don't.
All right, great. Thanks so much for coming on. And Cale and Kendall, thank you for all the great questions. Good discussion. Appreciate it. So send us those links. We'll put them along with the show notes. And best of luck to your podcast, Michael. Well, maybe we should come on there sometime just to have a little chit chat, you know. We'll see.
I mean, you all have your own area of expertise, right? So we could definitely have you folks on and talk about the security implications of some of the Azure features that you're passionate about. Absolutely.
Sounds good. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
You bet. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any thoughts, questions, or just want to connect, find us on Twitter at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixer.org under the Creative Commons license. We hope you'll tune in again soon to keep learning with us.